if there's someone like working at Apple or something like that, okay, and they see a budget like that, they're like, there's no way I can trust what's going to come out of this if it only costs this much, you know?
If you follow Motion Design Twitter, you've probably encountered today's guest. Austin Bowens is the co-founder of Ruby Studio in North Carolina and a bona fide motion design influencer. He's also 21 years old and running an 8-person studio, which is insanely impressive. In this chat, we dig into so much. Austin is a super interesting guy. We talk about how he started teaching himself to design when he was 12, how he dropped out of college 2 years early to focus on Ruby, the studio he was starting to build, and how he seemingly cracked the code of using social media to actually get client work. We also dig into a business model that Ruby tried out where they offered clients a subscription to motion design services, a crazy idea that's gotten more popular lately, especially in the world of web and product design. Austin is an incredibly sharp guy and an awesome example of the new generation of motion designers who are starting to make waves. It was an honor to chat with him, and I think you're going to love this episode. So let's get to it. Austin, it is amazing to finally have you on the podcast. You've been like a really long requested guest, so I'm glad to finally have you, and thanks for doing this.
Oh, sweet. Dude, I'm glad to be here and just honored that people wanted to hear me chat.
The first thing I want to ask you about, actually, is your age. I had no idea how young you were until you filled out like the pre-interview questionnaire. And you know, I say it as a compliment. Like, you know, you've accomplished a lot, and you're pretty well known in the industry for someone who hasn't been in it for very long. And so that's really impressive. But I'm curious, you know, like, do you feel young in this industry? Do you feel like the young guy when you're talking to your clients and stuff?
I did for a while. I mean, Ruby's been around for 3 years ish, but I started design when I was 12. Like, I mean, just as a hobby. So back then I'm like 14, DMing people on Twitter, trying to get like small projects and stuff. And I'm just like, hey, yeah, I'm totally like 18 or something. It's fine. And so now it's a little bit easier now that I've had more meetings under my belt and those sorts of things. Like client relations side, it's a lot easier. And I think it's funny. Most of our clients also think that Noah and I are like 28, almost 30-ish. So it's pretty well kept at this point. I mean, we're not like trying to hide our age or anything, but I think our mannerisms and stuff just hide it pretty well.
Interesting. So, okay. So if you started when you were 12 and you're 21 now, correct?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So you just recently like were able to buy alcohol legally.
Yeah.
Running the studio for 3 years. That's amazing, man. So, okay. So you've technically almost been doing this for a decade professionally, which is really cool. So I'd love to just kind of hear your story. Like, how did you start doing design? You know, like I remember, you know, getting like a cracked version of Photoshop when I was in high school and putting all the filters on everything and figuring out how it works. It was a lot harder when I was 12. So I'm 42. I'm literally twice your age.
Yeah.
It was a lot harder to like find out how to do stuff. There wasn't really tutorials back then. So how did you get into this? I'd love to kind of hear the story of how you went from 12-year-old Austin to 21-year-old, you know, founder of Ruby Studio.
I got you. So you can thank my 7th grade friend, Matt. He started a deodorant company, of all things. You might wonder how like a seventh grader can make deodorant, but you know, you got to do it.
Yeah.
And he was getting super popular in school. And I was getting super jealous because this like business is being cool thing was like, oh, shoot, I got to have my thing. And so I was like, I'm going to start my own thing. And it's going to be making mice and keyboards somehow. But you find out that like between Texas history and biology class, that's kind of difficult. It kind of spiraled into just making templates online for people. I had like posted on a Minecraft forum a long time ago because I was making gaming YouTube videos at the time, as you do. And I got a lot of people just willing to help out for free. I mean, we're all just kind of volunteering to try this out. And we were originally going to make games after we decided tech wasn't for us. But then somebody on the team, I can't even remember their name, honestly, lived in Sweden and they had some design sensibilities. So they made like YouTube banner templates and those sorts of things. And he didn't show up to the Skype chat one day. So since we had a new 99 cent order, I wasn't just going to let that sit. I'm like, I'm rich. 99 cents. Let's
get that
go,
bag,
dude.
Man. Yeah.
And so then I downloaded GIMP and just knocked it out. And the rest is kind of history. I just started making a bunch of like small time projects, YouTube banners, profile pictures, you name it, for different social media creators, YouTube personalities, all that sort of stuff. And eventually I got into animation. Just as a next step, I was seeing all these people make stream alerts and those sorts of things for gaming live stream graphics. And I was like, well, crap, I want to learn how to do that. That seems so fun. And not wanting to learn After Effects because I was terrified, I thought the easier way would be frame by frame, like, you know, little ants marching, you select your text in Photoshop or something and just like take my brush, fill up a little piece, save that image, fill up another little that image, whatever. And I was like, this is so much easier than learning After Effects, whatever. And it's not until I'm in my high school news program that my teacher is finally like, dude, you just got to take time to just try out After Effects, okay? Because I'm doing the calendar segment on the show, and so it's like 1,800 frames a week or something. I'm just sitting there by hand, like, trying to just knock the frames out and stuff. And then I think it was, I mean, as soon as I found the power of After Effects, I was just immediately like, yeah, why was I doing it this way? I'm just doing
how old
like
were
shape
you when you started
stuff.
Using After Effects? Like, how, what, at what age were you?
It's like senior year of high school. I was probably 17 at that point. Okay, cool. And so only like 4 years ago, maybe almost 5 years now. But yeah, it's from there. I actually started using After Effects. I started posting some of the work I was doing for that high school news program on Twitter and just fell into this world of motion design, doing a lot of freelance projects at first.
Let me pull you back a little bit. So you mentioned something I'm actually pretty curious about. So like when I was starting out, there was this, you know, like the cool thing that everyone was doing that led them into motion design. A lot of times it was like making skateboarding videos. So that was a big thing. And that really influenced the aesthetic of what, you know, sort of like early motion graphics artists, as we called them back then, were doing. And, you know, I have kids. So I have like a 13-year-old, I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old son who's obsessed. He's obsessed with Minecraft. And he watches YouTube all day long and loves watching Minecraft videos. And I'm blown away by some of the production value that people will put into,
I know,
like music videos about Minecraft and stuff like that. And so, you know, you're telling me about, you know, like you wanted to make streaming animations, you know, these sort of, you know, live stream notifications, and you're playing Minecraft and you're running sort of like a Minecraft-ish design sort of thing.
Yeah.
So like, what were your, does that influence the work you're doing now as a professional running a studio?
I think so. And it's funny that one of our team members is from this is from that community now, actually. But there was graphic designers in the gaming space, and they'd handle all of the banners and profile photos and those sorts of things. But then there were the intro makers, okay? And those were like the hot commodity, okay? Yeah, everybody wanted a cool, like a Minecraft intro to put on their YouTube channel with their player skin in there and their name and whatever. And there was just tons of people out there that were just doing it for free, just practicing their skill sets. And I was just super jealous. Like, I was out there trying to be like, can you make me an intro still? Like, I have no idea how to do this, but I can do some design stuff. And I think that a lot of the work that Ruvi is known for at this point is just like snappy MoGraph is what I hear a lot from other studio owners and things. And I think a lot of that comes from the same sort of motion design principles that were happening, unbeknownst to me, with these Minecraft intros. I mean, it's like, boom, bang, got to get to the point pretty quick. It's like gaming focused. There's lots of impact. And so, yeah, I think at least for my design sensibilities and things, there's still a lot of that that's rooted there today.
That's really cool. And how did you actually go about learning After Effects? I mean, if it was only 4 years ago, you could have taken a school motion class.
Yeah,
yeah, but I'm always curious because, I mean, you know, I watched some of your videos that you put on social media, those little mini tutorials, and other people on your team are doing that too, and they're really, really good. And the work you guys do is amazing. I mean, it's designed really well. The animation's awesome. So where did that come from? I mean, 4 years is not a long time to be animating. So how did you get those skills? How much of what I'm looking at on your website is you versus the rest of your team?
So now the website that we've updated in like the past couple weeks is the whole team. There might be a video on there that is still just Noah and I, but the vast majority of it is the whole team. I spent a lot of time in branding and static graphics to start with. Okay, so like composition and a lot of the design principles I'd already kind of just had down because of just, you know, you put shapes on a page so many times, it's just kind of instinctual after a certain point.
Right.
Animation wise, I had already been doing some frame by frame, like I said. So like that gave me some idea of like, I didn't have a graph or anything, but I was actively like already thinking about the acceleration and the easing without knowing the terminology. So when I had been told about After Effects, I found all the buttons and the graphs and other things. And I made it my mission that like every day in class, if we didn't have an assignment, I was going through every single tab and every effect, and I would just put it on a solid and try it and just see what it did until like just building up that library, sort of just experimenting and messing around with it. And then, of course, YouTube tutorials. You know, I mean, I think a lot of tutorials I sort of struggle with if it's really prescriptive, like put in these values and these numbers, because it's so hard to be like, okay, well, now I know how to do that specific sequence, but like, what do I do from there?
Yeah.
So there was this one tutorial I watched that I think it's by this guy called Tip Tut. They had like a couple free videos. And what I loved at the start of the video was that he said, I'm not going to give you any values. I'm not going to show you any of the stuff that I'm doing. I'm just going to be like in the panels. I'll make some things, but I'm not going to be like belaboring over the specific settings or anything like that. And what that forced me to do was have to experiment and mess with the things myself to sort of get what I felt worked. And so, you know, I sort of took that mindset and just tried to get through every element of After Effects until I felt like I was solid enough at it. And then I was like, all right, let me take those skills and try and make some things, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I noticed, like, looking at especially some of the, you know, the quick, like, you know, 3-4-5 hour things that you post on social mm-hmm. media, there are a lot of like glows and blurs
yeah.
and you know, effects on it. And, you know, there was kind of a thing for a few years, like I guess a trend of animators trying not to use many effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, the guy that teaches our beginner After Effects class, his name is Noel. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's a little bit older than me, but he lives in New York City and he's an amazing animator. But he doesn't really use effects very often. Like, it's pretty rare. He'll use like a few. And but the work you're doing, I mean, I could see, like, you know, some deep glow and all kinds of stuff.
Gotta
on there.
Do it.
So I definitely feel that influence. So it's interesting that do you have any formal animation training, or did you really just kind of figure it out
yeah,
the hard way?
Yeah, just a trial and error process, honestly. I went to college for, 2 years and then decided to drop out. But that was for graphic design, because at that point, yep. I was dead set. I'm like, all right, I've sold so many logos at this point. This is what I'm going to be doing forever, whatever. And so I thought that graphic design was just going to be my thing. But at the point where I decided to leave school, I'd already been animating for a little while, so I just kept on experimenting, and sort of just gut instinct has taken me in good places, I guess, luckily.
Yeah, that's good. So you mentioned in the pre-interview, mm-hmm. I asked, you know, I ask every guest, like, what's one of the biggest mistakes you've ever made? And you said mm-hmm. not dropping out of college sooner. So, which, like, that, you know, and it's funny. I mean, you know, I mentioned I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she'll mm-hmm. be college age in 5 years, and like, I feel totally differently about college than I did growing up, and then yeah. most of my friends with kids do. So I'm curious, you know, as someone who like just left college pretty recently
mm-hmm.
and dropped out, and now you're successful, right? And I mean, you're successful in the field that I tell people you don't need to go to college for.
Yeah.
You know, I beat that drum. So talk to me about your college experience and what made you realize you didn't actually need to finish.
Yeah. So throughout all of primary school and high school, I was very focused on grades. I mean, if it wasn't A's, I was not happy yeah. with it, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was instilled in me very early on that, like, college, like, that's what we're doing. That's what we're here for. We're going to go get into school. And so grades were, like, super big focus, AP classes, whatever, all that, a whole thing. And within that same mindset, when I decided I wanted to do graphic design as my major, around, like, the beginning of my senior year of high school, I went and toured a ton of different schools. I mean, my parents were kind enough to take us on this like cross-country road trip and go look at like 9 different schools.
Nice.
And so I'd actually been swayed a lot by the dining halls. A lot of them that wasn't really the programs as much. But eventually I sort of like whittled the list down, and it really came down to the school's marketing. So now I realize there's a lot of different places where schools can pay to have like their name listed as like top blank program and that yeah. sort of stuff. And so I thought, I'm like, all right, if I'm going to go to school, I'm going out of state, I'm going to the best graphic design program in the country. And I decided to go to NC State University. Part of the reason being, a lot of other schools, when I looked at their portfolios online, were doing a lot of similar work that I was already doing in like their senior classes and things. So I'm like, if I'm going to be doing the same thing, like, what's really the point? But this one was talking about like VR and AR applications and maybe some more interactive things. And so I am coming from Houston, Texas. I'm going to Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm not going to know anybody there. And so I'm doing the Gen Z thing, and I'm like making group chats. I'm trying to find people that are in like the same program as me. And in doing that, I actually luckily found my co-founder, Noah, or would-be co-founder. But I was like super shy in high school, didn't know anybody. I just kind of kept to myself. But some of my work gets around at the school before I get there. And suddenly I'm like walking on campus and like people are verbally calling me like design guy, whatever the hell that means.
Nice.
And so it's like a complete 180 in my social life. I've got a bunch of people who are like actually caring about the stuff I cared about my entire school experience. Because if I'm not in class, I'm working on whatever studio I was running at the time. And as a result, I was coming in with a lot more experience than I thought I had at the time. And, you know, a lot of colleges have their first semester be this like all-rounded art course. And so I spent the first 3 months making a paper wearable costume. I mean, it looked ridiculous. I'm really bad at physical craft. It's just not my interest. And so the skill set's not there. My professors would get mad at me because I was spending like more time on my presentation slides because I was like there for graphic design than my paper wearable costume.
Yeah.
And so I had this kind of rift early on. I was like, I don't know if like graphic design is the program for me or like what the issue is here. But I was feeling kind of funky about it. Noah and I had made friends at this point. So we're kind of feeling the same thing. But I decided to write it out because I'm like, it's college. You know, I'm going to get my degree. These things happen. Maybe I'm just not adjusted to it yet. And so then I'm thinking a little more creatively. I'm like, all right, what if there's a way to potentially test out of some programs or something? Because this is a very regimented thing. I mean, you had like you had to do the all-rounded art course with a lot of exploratory things. Then you'd get to start your graphic design classes, which were really just either typography and print focused or modeling things to like 3D print and laser cut and stuff. It just wasn't making sense to me for the track I saw career-wise. And so it gets to a certain point where the school actually ends up deciding that they want to change the major in the middle of us being there, which is like, okay, how are we going to deal with this? Where it was going to be much more experience design focused. So we're talking like wayfinding systems, museum exhibits, and those sorts of things. And I'm like, that's not really what I'm here for. And so a lot of other students were understandably concerned about that as well. But Noah and I were really the only ones that were freelancing out of the student body. And I mean, we're only sophomores at that point still. But we're meeting with alumni that are saying like, man, I got out of school and like I'm just not able to find jobs in this. I'm having to like relearn everything about the field once I get out into like the real world. And I'm like, oh, shoot, this is rough. So then as you do, we started a like accountability group essentially so that we could bring in people that I was meeting at my internship at the time and that we just met in the field to sort of help out our classmates and get advice and do Q&As and that sort of stuff. And then at the same time, we were like, oh, crap, they're going to change the major. I don't know how we feel about this. So we all decided to write up a potential curriculum suggestion here. And traditional academia did not take too kindly to that. We had this town hall to talk about it. I mean, it was like a third of the whole student body of graphic design signed on to this thing being like, hey, we got to figure something out here or we're going to have to leave. And the school was real crafty. They like waited until nobody could get tuition refunds before they talked with us about it. And then when they did talk to us about it, we were like scoffed at for our concerns and stuff. I mean, it was abysmal. And so we were like, all right, nothing's changing. We thought they kicked our asses handily. And then when we thought it was over, we're like, all right, Noah and I are going to drop out. We've already been running review for a little bit at this point. The school sends out a letter to the whole graphic design student body, essentially just trying to give a bunch of like reasoning on why they want to change the program and whatever. And keeping in mind, Noah and I are really the only ones freelancing in the program at this point. They have this little bottom section, the very bottom of the email. I mean, this is like the founder of the program sending this thing out. And I don't remember the exact quote. However, they said, essentially, it seems to us that some beginning petitioners are using their freelance level experience to like justify changes in the curriculum and will have little to no upward mobility in their entire career. And it was like, oh, all right. So we definitely weren't welcome there, but we just had to kind of wait it out until the end of the semester to just, you know, move on after that point. But it, you know, it gives a good, like, hey, here's what they said. We couldn't do it. Now here we are type thing, I guess. It's a good motivator, you know?
Yeah. You know, you've got a pretty big, you know, social media following, and I think it's going to grow a lot. So I'm hoping that there's a lot of artists your age, maybe even a little bit younger listening to this. And, you know, your answer is interesting because I was expecting the first part, which was you get there and you realize, wait, what I'm learning isn't actually really applicable in a lot of cases to what I'm doing. And the only reason you knew that was because you were doing work already, right? And I've heard you say this before in like a video you posted once. It was like, look, you know, going to school, taking classes, those can be useful things if you need the structure and you have no idea where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
But the fastest way to learn is to actually just jump in and start doing it. And that's what you were doing. I didn't expect to hear the politics part of it, which, you know, I taught at a school for 1 year, so I have some experience with that. But it's gnarly, man. And I'm sure the tuition was super high and you were out of state. So,
yeah.
You know, I got to imagine if you took out loans, you're still paying those back.
Wild experience, man.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, interesting. Well, I brought it up because, you know, I think that's still a big question to a lot of people who, you know, I think it's a lot easier now to look around as a young person and see that you can have a career being an artist, designer, animator, stuff like that. You know, when I was growing up, it wasn't all that clear that that was going to be possible.
Yeah.
And it certainly wasn't clear that you can actually like make money doing it. So I hope people are listening and they hear about your experience and it causes them to think a little bit before they just, you know, sign that, sign that Sally Mae form and take on, you know, $200,000 to $300,000 of debt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have to be that way. And I think my favorite way to think about it now is I'm just terrified at the thought that there's like a version of me that, I mean, I would have graduated this year in like May of this year that would have had to learn all of the things we've learned in the past 2 years with like no strings attached, just doing Revit starting now like that.
Yeah.
Whew, woof. I feel really glad that and kind of lucky that it feels like I have a head start a little bit in that aspect.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you this too. I mean, you know, starting, it doesn't matter. You start a studio, start any kind of business. Yeah, yeah. It's really hard. And, you know, the hardest hump to get over is like getting enough traction where the thing makes enough money to actually like stand up, right? And, you know, I was lucky when I started School of Motion that I had the ability to freelance because School of Motion made no money for years. You know, being 21, and you may disagree, but I mean, to me, it's a lot easier to afford life as a 21-year-old. I assume you're not married yet.
Yeah.
You know, versus if you tried to do that after a few years and maybe you were married, maybe you had a kid already, maybe you had a mortgage, it becomes almost impossible, you know, without basically not sleeping. So I don't know. I really admire what you did. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a good model for the way creatives should approach their career these days. I really don't think a degree in design or animation means much anymore.
Yeah.
And I know I'll probably get blasted for that, but go ahead. Give it to me in the YouTube comments.
Bring out the pitchforks. Let's go.
Yeah, bring it on. So, okay. So let's get into to Revit a little bit. So you were doing it in school.
Yep.
And the, you know, the most obvious kind of unique thing about Revit to me, aside from the fact that you're 21 and you founded it with someone I assume is also the same age.
Yeah.
You have a big focus on creating content. And, you know, I know a lot of studio owners who have like directors of business development that are literally like outbound sales experts, right?
Yeah.
And they're using Salesforce and they're doing all the things you traditionally do. You know, you come from the generation where you've probably grown up online most of your life, if not your entire life, right? So I'm curious, like, did that start in college, like making videos, posting, trying to build a following? Like, when did that start and when did you start to incorporate that into Revit?
I think we were just sort of misguided for a little while. We had the rose-colored glasses of like, oh, look at this motion design industry. Like the way to do this is this specific path. And that path looked like make amazing client work that you can then post and have other motion designers appreciate and that sort of stuff. But in childhood, I mean, like I said, I loved making Minecraft YouTube videos. I just liked making fun content. But there was some point where the business part of me, whatever I expected a business to look like and what that meant to be a real business, took that over and was like, no, you have to do it this way. And so for a while, we're like trying to get clients that will make us look good rather than the focus should be like making good stuff for clients, right, regardless of who it is, you know? And of course, that has other ramifications of like, if every project that you're doing is just like this cloud of, but it has to be really good so I can put it on my portfolio, that's going to make for some awful experiences for the client, you know?
Correct.
But anyway, at some point, the business was at a real low, both financially and from a creative perspective. And this is probably like at the end of our real first year. And I was just so tired of the same old corporate video that we were getting made every single time. Everything was just super slow. And I was feeling that like Minecraft intro maker in me wanting to come back out and just like, can I just make some stuff that feels punchy and fast, you know? And I did that and posted to our like 700 followers at the time. I made this fun little like colorful grid that moves around or something. And we would usually get, I mean, like a couple hundred views on something on Instagram. And this thing got like 1,500 overnight or something like that. I was like, okay, that's weird. Because I wasn't posting it intending on it getting a big audience. I was just like, hey, I just made this thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because the only things I thought about, oh, I want to make sure we get views, is posting a client project, you know? And so then I was like, all right, I'm going to do this again. I'll make another one next week, whatever. And then I made another one. People loved that one even more. And I was like, holy crap. Wait, we're getting like leads from this too? This is crazy. Like people are just coming in just saying like, do your thing. Like we just want you to make your video for us. And it's like, whoa, this is a crazy thing. Like I have a big red sales button I can hit every week now. Like that feels insane. And so it's at that point that I sort of got brought back. I was like, hold on a second. I just did this because I thought it'd be fun. Like this is just coming from a place of passion and interest. And as a result, I not only could make things that I just felt captivated by, but also I had the energy to come back to it week after week after week and do it, not because I felt like I had to make a sale, but because I was still enjoying it, you know? And it's at that point where we're really like, oh my God, like we'd run some paid ad campaigns on Google and other things like that before. And it's just like sinking money into these things. But yeah. Then you post on organic social. And if you can find something that works for you, it's just like a night and day difference in your business. I mean, it is a complete turnaround.
So what kind of clients, you know, if you're posting some really interesting animation exercise that you just did, mm-hmm. or even if it's like an internal project, it's you and your co-founder and mm-hmm. maybe, I don't know if you had employees at the time,
yeah.
and you just post it, right? And there's no logo at the end. It's not for anything. It just looks cool. What kind of clients is that attracting?
So it's actually a pretty mixed bag. I would have thought initially it would have just been other studios or something like that. But we actually got a lot of larger agencies that would reach out, as well as just direct to brand. Like, I mean, we've always had a type form on our website, and sure, it'd be people from like some local agencies that we knew or those sorts of things that would show up. But then you get like blanket KellerWilliams.com. And I'm like, why is this giant real estate company showing up in our contact form? Just like offhand, you know? And the thing was, it wasn't pushing it from an ad perspective. It was making it just purely from an artistic standpoint. So what that meant was realistically, anybody could enjoy that. And if it gets pushed well enough and has enough views, then you could reach people that are, sure, just like your average everyday person that might not be able to hire us or something. But you could also reach a creative director somewhere, and it just kind of gets passed around, you know?
That's interesting. Now, did you find that as you did that, mm-hmm. your following grew? Because then, you know, people are now aware of you, yeah. which means each post you make gets more reach. So now there's even more leads. Did it work that way? Was there sort of a flywheel effect to it?
It really did. It was like an infinite energy machine. It was kind of wild. I mean, I think when I posted the first ones, I might have had like around 700 to 1,000 followers on Instagram or something. And I mean, like a month from then, I had 10,000. And it was just like, where did this come from? And then a month after that, it's up to like 28 or something like that. And I mean, I wish I could reach the views that one of our video editors is able to get on his stuff. But I mean, for motion design content, we were getting like 150, 200,000 views a post for like a solid month straight. And it was just wild because that's so many eyeballs just over and over again on that stuff.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Okay, so what did that do? And be as specific as you can. So like for your business, right? Like, before you're doing that, you know, how many jobs are you getting? What kind of revenue is Ravi doing? And then how did it grow year over year as you started, you know, implementing that strategy?
So we started in August of 2020, like right mm-hmm. in the middle of the pandemic. And so from August of 2020 up until December of that year, we might have made like $7,000. Like it really wasn't much.
That's not a lot.
No, it's really not. And then that next year, we had done 100,000 in revenue by the end of the year. And that was without any of the social media stuff. And then 2022 is when we start posting some the loops. And that year was 500,000 last year. And it was, I mean, we went from having a project at a time that would last for maybe 2 months or something. And then you just kind of go on that cycle to every single week we were getting new leads in our inbox that were qualified, valuable leads, to where we were working on like three projects at a time. And those would switch out every 2 months instead of one project every 2 months. And the actual value was way higher. I mean, we were initially charging like sub 10K for projects. And then once that starts happening, I mean, we got up to like 30,000 average on those deals. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still a lot of them are just explainer videos and they're kind of short. So it wasn't like huge money makers, like a package of assets or anything like that. But we could get there eventually, you know?
Yeah. And so how is 2023 looking? Because, you know, it's kind of a weird time right now. 2022, that's kind of when the economic bubble that was inflated during COVID burst.
Yeah.
And I think it's still kind of bursting in real time. So how's this year been for you?
So we've already sold as much as we did last year. So we're already looking at 500,000. Initially, if you would have asked me middle of the year, early year, I would have said that we were looking to hit 1 million this year.
Yeah.
I am still hopeful that that happens because the end of the year is usually a lottery for us. Like just a lot of work comes in. However, I am seeing across the board that that's not happening nearly as much even in Q4. So I don't know. We'll still hit more than we did last year, but it might end up being around like 750 rather than a million. But even so, in a downturn, that's a huge win to me at that point, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. How big is your team right now?
So we're 8 people now. Noah and I are co-founders, and everybody else is essentially contracted, but everybody's around all the time because we've got
that's great. So you're right at the cusp, man. I mean, you know, 8 people, I'm kind of doing like some rough math in my head. I mean, it's profitable. It's probably not like super over the top profitable yet, but you're on track. Okay. And has that strategy worked as well this year? Are you seeing like any diminishing returns with it or anything?
Well, so, all right, there's Instagram loves to Instagram especially loves to give you a big boost. OK, and we've been able to replicate that pretty well. I mean, my co-founder Noah had a very similar journey this year that I had last year. However, it seems like, and I don't know any actual statistics on this, you get up to like 25,000 followers or something, it'll give you a nice push. And then like the faucet turns off in some way. I don't know why. It can be you making the same content. You can be making stuff that you think is better. It's just a weird numbers game algorithmically on some of these things. But the thing is now that we were able to capitalize so well during that time, like we weren't just riding the wave so much. We were trying to future-proof some things in terms of like building community and like really getting integrated with those connections we were making so that if that did happen and we were getting less of a return on social, it's not as big of a deal now because now we've got the thing that a lot of other people had and we didn't, which is a network, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would say like we're still not getting bad numbers by any means. I mean, I could post anything on my personal and still get like 10,000 views or something minimum. But it's definitely not as potent as it was back then. We're not in the big red sales button territory anymore. And that's made this year difficult in a lot of ways, just in terms of trying to relearn how to be a salesperson and not just like having a bunch of stuff coming in, you know?
Yeah. So the thing that, you know, like I've talked a lot about how I got work and I've coached other people on how to do it, mostly freelancers, but you know, I ran a studio for 4 years. And, you know, the strategy that you're using primarily, the social media strategy, I've seen it work so well for certain people. I think, you know, you have to have like a certain caliber of work for that strategy to really work. And you guys definitely do. But I've always been a little bit afraid of it because of what you're talking about. It's like when it works, it works. Yeah. When it doesn't, it's hard to identify why it's not working. It's hard to know. Is it us? Is our work not as good? Is there more competition? Did the algorithm change? Right. Yeah. So that is interesting. I wanted to ask you this too, because this is something that I kind of selfishly want to ask you this because I wonder about this. So like, you know, when we post certain things as School of Motion, it does okay. But if I post it as Joey, it does way better because there's kind of this dynamic of like, oh, I'd rather follow a person than a company. So
I know
when you're posting things, like how do you think about that? Like posting as Austin versus posting as Ruby?
That's been a struggle in the sense that we have wanted to not have it be so just associated with me. Like having a team and it not just being me and Noah anymore, it's hard for people on the team if it's just like I'm getting the credit for these things, you know? And that doesn't feel right to me either. We've tried to brand things as more Ruby. A lot of what we've been doing this year has been collaborations as a team to sort of be like, hey, this is the actual set of people, not just me. But you are right that I think just naturally these platforms are able to understand if it's a business that's trying to say something and they want those ad dollars, you know?
Yeah.
So even from like, there's the personal standpoint where like, I would rather follow a person than a brand. But also I think on a platform level, that's probably the case in some ways too. What that means to me now is that I just try not to be as reliant on the brand. Like initially, when I started in business, even as like a 12-year-old, like the initial thing for me, like the golden goose was like, oh, I want so many people to care about my company, you know? But I just think that's a facade in some ways these days, you know? It's just not super achievable. And I think it's healthier for us as a team now. Ruby is what we have in its current form is a production arm of Motion Design Services, you know, but there's other things that we want to do. And so if we just become shoehorned into like, blah, 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 Ruby, like this motion design thing, it limits our options to be able to do other things. And so instead, coming at it from, wait a second, instead of a brand account that's just putting things out for all of us, why don't we have 8 accounts because we're 8 people and we can have our own audiences? It's like the sitcom effect, kind of, you know, there's mm-hmm. your cast of characters and people will resonate with some more than others. And it's just, eventually it's a huge network effect, because even though I might have the faucet turned off on me a little bit now, it feels like we as a company now have like 200,000 followers across everybody's stuff. And that gives us way more reach than if we were just focused on like, how can we make Revi this household name or something like that, you know? So we're trying much more to have people just care about us, the team, as people. And Revi is just kind of like the banner we fly under, rather than trying to make that work if it's just not as much on social.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, there's one of your staff, I think his name's Will, he's a mm-hmm. British guy, yeah. really young and really talented. And I see his content, and it's totally different than yours, like totally yep. different flavor. And it strikes me, I mean this in the best way, it yeah. strikes me as the kind of stuff that like my kids are watching on TikTok. Yep. It's just very good motion design kind of content and stuff like that. How does that then work if that piece of content from one of your employees brings in work? Like, you know, how do you incentivize your team to do this? Or do they just like doing it because that's kind of how Gen Z is? You're just always posting and you live your life online.
Well, it's both, actually. Everybody just loves making content on the team. We're all passionate yeah. about it. It's just taking our creativity back in under our own control instead of always using it for others, you know? So in that way, it's fun. But also, we have a commission structure where on any given project that would actually come in, it's like 5% directly to the person that brought it in. But
That's so smart.
Yeah. That hasn't really been activated yet because, yeah. again, we are still battling a little bit of the leads and things still come through me in a lot of ways, like just Austin Bowen's Instagram account, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to find ways, because I just, for the past 3 years, like, my life has been Revi. Like, I'm trying to get projects as much as possible, whatever. And so I naturally have made this funnel that works pretty well, to where even if people see me as an individual, they know Revi is where to go to actually get a project or whatever. Mm-hmm.
This is like a changing dynamic that mm-hmm. it's really interesting. I mean, it seems, you know, it sounds like you're kind of experimenting and trying to figure out how to best make something like this work. But I'm fascinated by, like, you know, the business model of Mr. Beast, for example, right?
Yeah.
So, and even like, you know, take School of Motion as an example, right? So like, we're a bigger company in the education space for motion design, right? I think we have 21, 22 full-time people now. And, you know, and so when you have that, you know, operations just get more complicated. Yeah. It becomes a little more difficult to like just quickly spin out something cool, right? Like, because there's more people involved mm-hmm. versus like, you know, someone like you or a Ben Marriott or, you know, Jake Bartlett, who also teaches for us. You know, these are like sort of, you know, lone wolves. They can just do stuff real quick. And Mr. Yeah. Beast can run circles around production companies that typically would work with Netflix or something like that and have to hire 100 people to make something. And Mr. Beast built his own thing from scratch. And now he's got a big team, but he's also bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars a year, right?
Yeah.
So he can do that. And so there's this dynamic shift of like, you know, I think people are more into following individual creators than brands.
Yeah.
And so if you're a brand, it's actually kind of a tricky space. So the way you're doing it is interesting, like taking your brand, but treating it almost like a seal of approval or something, or an umbrella that your team can work underneath and incentivizing them to do that. So that, like, how do you see that, you know, like, has it worked at all? Like, do you have a good feeling about this, or is this just like an experiment you're trying?
I feel pretty good about it. It's a good foundation. Like, I'm not necessarily super worried about, is everybody going to be able to bring in X amount of sales or anything like that. I think that it just makes sure that everybody on the team understands the level of ownership and the importance just of them as an individual, so they're not just another person on the team mm-hmm. executing some task or something. And that makes it so that rather than preemptively deciding like, oh, we might need this department or this category of business or those sorts of things, teams naturally form on initiatives that people are just excited about on the team. And that lets us do anything, because rather than, like what you were saying, where like Mr. Beast is able to run circles around those more traditionally structured companies, when you have a team like this that knows they can also break off into their own group and start their own initiative there, they can also run circles around other people on the team for specific yeah. things, you know? It sort of lets everybody use their strengths.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd be really curious to see how that scales as you guys continue to grow. I think yeah. that's a really neat model. Yeah.
I think this like core group of eight is that foundation. We've all kind of, we think it's going to be really hard to expand that group, because for as much as the company's been around for just a short while, Noah and I, it was just the two of us for the first 2 years. And pretty much every one of the other six people have shown up in the past 12 months. And what that means is we've all kind of been on this ride at like this level of RV for the same amount of time. It's going to be hard to onboard people in the same way that like haven't all been through that same stuff or those same things, you know?
Yeah, that's so true, man. I mean, and as the company grows, like, you know, like I remember when School Motion was less than 10 people and then we hit 10 and it was like all of a sudden there was like a state change. Like everything kind of works a little differently. And then you get to, you know, like 15, 16. And again, like it feels a little different. So you'll go through all that. I mean, I really like that you're trying stuff like this, though. And one of the things I want to talk about in a little bit is you tried doing an interesting business model around selling a subscription to your services. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you about the transition that you've had to make. So you mentioned also in a pre-interview that you used to be like on the box artist all the time.
Yeah.
And now you've got this team, right? So now you're probably doing a lot more businessy things, and and God forbid, you might actually be managing your team and doing like, you know, reviews and stuff like that. So how has that been for you? And how have you, you know, tried to educate yourself on like the best practices, how to be a good boss and all that?
I mean, I think it is helpful how transparent Noah and I are in a lot of ways. I mean, publicly, we're very transparent, but that translates to the team as well. I mean, everybody knows what everybody on the team is making, how much Noah and I make, how much the projects are, all everything from like a financial standpoint is open to everybody. So that avoids any of the usual ick I think people have from a business structure. You know, we try and remove as much of the like corporate hierarchy as possible. The only stipulation is really that just like Noah and I have the ownership in the studio, but it really feels like a democracy in terms of just the day-to-day decisions and those sorts of things. The transition though from working on production all the time to where I'm at now hasn't been as drastic as I thought it would be. It feels a little more stark in the past couple weeks, even that like I have been a lot less in production these past couple weeks, but I am still, for the vast majority of our projects, I'm doing a scene or two for a lot of things. But it's the usual things I think a lot of people go through. It's trusting yourself to trust others to get things done for clients is a really hard thing to build from a self-esteem standpoint. It's just like, oh man, like is the communication going to be there on things? Is the like quality of work going to be there? A couple times where you just got to stomach like, oh, that's not how I would have made something, but I have to present this, you know? But thankfully everybody on the team has been very open with each other throughout the process. I mean, if there is a problem anybody has, it's brought up like immediately. We discuss it as a group and it works out. But that's not made it that hard, because now rather than just being focused on production and like having so much of it have to rely on me, because for a long time I was just the fastest one on the team. So I was able to just like, all right, come in, get some stuff done, whatever. Now I'm able to take that energy and help try and just future-proof the company to where it's not just reliant on like motion design and like the whim of the economy and the industry and that sort of thing. So I think the team understands the vision well, and I'm still in on production in enough ways to where there isn't any like, what the hell is my boss doing type feelings or any of that sort of stuff, which is like my main thing I try to avoid.
Yeah. And are you guys like remote? Do you have an office? Like how do you actually work?
So I have this office space just because I don't like working from home that much. I just got too much of it since we started during COVID. But everybody is remote. Noah used to be here with me in Raleigh, but now he's in New York. We've got a video editor in St. Louis, or sorry, not St. Louis, but he's in Missouri. Another guy in Atlanta. Then we've got, as you said, Will's in the UK. We've got another person in New York, someone in Montenegro, and someone in Morocco. So, I mean, we're like a bunch of different time zones and everybody is remote at this point. But we're not missing as much of the office culture as I thought we would be, because again, we started all online anyway. So we just have a Discord, internal Discord server that we use where we're all pretty much just sitting in the call as long as we're working, and people mute or deafen if they want or whatever. But that way we can just be like, have those tap on the shoulder type moments where it's like, hey, look at this thing I did. I need some feedback, whatever, that type of stuff. And it still feels like we're all in an office anyway, which I think was one of the things I was worried about most in bringing people on, but we've managed to make it work.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, I can tell you from experience, like that does work pretty well at the size you're at. It gets a lot harder if you get bigger. So again, that's one of those things I'm really curious to watch your trajectory, you know, because I think what's going to happen, your work is good. And you know, the way that you approach business development, like is clearly working. And I think once the economy turns around, you guys are going to grow, and it's going to be fun to kind of watch and see if you can maintain that, you know, that feeling and that vibe. It's really difficult, man, but yeah, you got the right mindset. So I want to talk about the business development side of things too, sure, because as you grow, my gut is, and I'm curious what you think, my gut is that there's some scale where relying on social media as like your primary sales channel, mm-hmm, probably breaks down, and maybe at that point you have to like start paying to get greater reach and target, you know, you have to run LinkedIn ads and like post this stuff there, but pay to like target creative directors or, you know, whoever at agencies, whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's also the traditional way that, you know, a lot of studios go out and they get business and they call people on the phone, you know, and they send emails all day long, take people out to lunch, go to Promax, BDA, stuff like that. Are you doing any of that? Do you think that that's going to be necessary to get to the next level?
We have always done some level of cold outreach. The period where we didn't do it for the longest was when things were really popping on social for mm-hmm. like the summer of 2022. But I mean, we go to industry events when we can. We've been to Dash Bash a couple times, and I just was lucky enough to go speak in LA at R&D, which is run by State. And so we go to some events like that. We really like those. It's a great way to also just like get the team together since we are all remote. And otherwise, yeah, we've tried paid ads in the past. We have not been fantastic at that, mostly in the sense that just like, it's funny, the organic social brings in the quality lead for us, you know, with the right budget and it's the right type of person. But when we try and target that person on paid ads, we usually get the, hey, can you make a 30-second video for $400? Is that cool?
Right.
Think you can do that? And so it's just been really hard from a like paid reach standpoint to justify that. But you know, LinkedIn messaging, warm connections, that sort of stuff, email. But it's usually just like if we really think that we will need a project at some point, we don't do it a whole lot. Yeah. But we've tried so many different things too. I mean, Noah and I just feel gross as salespeople sometimes, you know, and we just try and stay away from the sort of uncomfortable like salesy things sometimes.
Totally, yeah.
But that's led us in some interesting directions. I mean, I've, instead of sending an email sometimes, I'll write a very brief email, but then I will record a video for them where I am actually just talking with what I'd say in the email, because, you know, you get your face in there and whatever. But it still doesn't really increase the response rate that much. I don't know. It just, all of cold outreach feels very foreign to us. And so that's why we're so gravitated towards the social media organic side of things, because it just is where it feels like we can really be us. And when we have tried to be more us in a cold outreach standpoint, it's like there's this language that we just don't understand in some ways about how to get some responses and those sorts of things.
It's a totally different mindset. You know, yeah. I mean, if you're posting things on social and someone responds with a work inquiry, it's because they're looking for someone to do something right then, right?
Right.
And you're just catching them at the right time. And when you're doing paid advertisements, you're catching people maybe when they're not looking, but then they think of something. And you really need, my gut is that you really need like a built out sales process where that's the top of the funnel is like the paid part. But then you probably need to like get on a Zoom call or something and actually like sell it through and qualify leads and all the stuff
right.
that you probably don't really feel like doing. But you know, I see a lot of success from bigger studios, especially where you have to do that at some level until you have the relationships that go back 10 years,
right.
15 years, and then you can kind of rely on repeat business and referrals and stuff. When I booked you on this, I asked mm-hmm. people like, you know, in School of Motion Slack and on Twitter, you know, what would you like me to talk to Austin about? And the number one thing was the subscription service, because that, you know, there's three or four artists, you know, currently that I know are talking about and doing this publicly. They're starting up, just for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what we're talking about. There's this business model that, you know, you're very familiar with, software as a service. So if you have a subscription to Dropbox or Slack or Frame.io, those are software as you pay a monthly fee. And now there's also service-based businesses that do this. Primarily, I've seen it for design, for software engineering, for copywriting, things like that, where there's this recurring need, but you don't always know when you're going to need it. And it's sometimes nice to just plan as a business. We're going to put someone on retainer and just have them available. And now people are trying to do that for motion design. So motion design subscription services. And I know you guys tried this.
Yep.
So I have a lot of thoughts on why this could work, why maybe it can't work. I'm curious. You actually tried it, so tell me the story and what you think. Before you hear Austin answer that, I want to tell you about our free weekly newsletter, Motion Mondays. This is a 5-minute email you'll get each Monday that will keep you up to date on new tools, events, and news in the worlds of animation, design, 3D, and visual effects. Pause this episode, head to motionmondays.com, link in the description, to sign up for free, and then come on back. Alrighty, let's get back to Austin.
Alright, so the number one reason we wanted to do it anyway, I don't know if this is the case for other people though, was, I mean, it's the ebb and flow of the revenue, obviously. When a lot of business is just coming in because someone somewhere else decides they need a project, and then you happen to be the chosen one for that. That's not a fantastic, repeatable business model, you know? Yeah. It's great that, like, as motion designers, we can get a good chunk of money for these projects. But if it carries you for a couple months and there isn't repeat stuff, then what's that going to do? And we didn't really have the relationships yet to just try and pursue retainers. And also, there's just certain expectations with that word that we, I don't think, felt really well-suited for. More just, like, imposter syndrome type thing. And so I saw some of these subscription services for especially product design, or mostly from like a UI standpoint, UI, UX design and that sort of thing. And I was like, well, I can figure out a way to make this work, because like you start doing the numbers in your head and you're like, okay, if we just get this many people paying this amount per month, we could have this kind of revenue per year. And it's like, gee, that sounds great, Austin, from a numbers perspective, but reality is not that for a studio, I don't think, for a couple different reasons. But what we tried was initially just reaching out to a couple of our clients and talking them through the idea and getting some feedback. And it helped inform some of the decisions. The number one problem we were running into is like, okay, how do we quantify what someone is able to receive monthly with the subscription or quarterly or whatever it is?
Right.
Because that can vary so much, whether it's 3D or 2D or if it's cell or whatever kind of animation, let alone the length or the amount of deliverables, any of that sort of stuff. And what we do for a lot of our projects, normally, just a flat rate, is charge oftentimes based on the length of the video. We've been able to get things pretty well oiled machine-wise to where if we just understand the length of the video, we can get a pretty good estimate. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, all right, what if we say that it costs, I don't remember the actual numbers for each of these, but our most expensive plan was like $8,000 a month or something. And that was going to get you 60 seconds worth of animation every month, which one is a severe price reduction of what,
right.
I mean, it's like way less than half. It's almost like it's less than a quarter of what we would normally charge for something like that. But the idea is that, you know, if you have that repeat business, you don't have to worry about that pricing as much, or at least that was the mentality at the time. So anyway, we essentially started saying like, all right, we're going to have these price plans based on the amount of the number of seconds of animation, those sorts of things. And then whatever is beyond that, or if there is a project that just can't fit within there, we'll bill that separately or something like that. And we thought there was a bunch of different ways you could do this. Like you could also limit that by like, okay, 60 seconds, but max 2 projects or something like that. But there were a couple things that started to go wrong pretty quickly once we deployed. First, I've been really surprised with how open a lot of people seem in the community to this now. But when we launched, people were not happy that we were thinking about doing this, and we were not getting good reception for it. And so that was one hurdle to tackle. But also, when we started doing outreach, we're like, oh, this is going to be like a no-brainer. I mean, instead of paying us like 5 times what they could get from the subscription, they can just pay that price and get our work instead. Like, who's going to say no to that? However, people don't trust a price that's that low if they're used to paying something else. Like, there is a certain level of like, why is this so cheap, that we were getting as a hesitation. And then when you try and increase the pricing, then suddenly it's too expensive. And like, we just could not get people to agree and match with the pricing very well. And so that was definitely an issue. But at the same time, we're also realizing, and funny enough, this is around when we start deciding after all of this friction that like, okay, maybe we should just go back to project-based stuff. Like, I don't know about this, is when we actually got some people interested. And so we get into some of these calls and we're talking through it. And then this light bulb goes off that, okay, we're a studio. We've got 8 people on our team and we are pricing things to like, first and foremost, try and make sure that we can pay people and that sort of stuff. And suddenly we realized, like, hold on, you're telling me it's going to be a good idea to say, like, yeah, you can get some recurring revenue, that's great. But if we were to sell a $70,000 project, okay, and that might, when we have done projects of that size, it's usually like a month or two worth of work.
Yeah.
We're going to have them pay that once for the whole year and do way more work, like, just because it's consistent money, even though it's less. Like, it just didn't make sense from a studio perspective. It's like, part of the marketing was they're like, oh my God, we can get cheaper than some of like the top freelancers with this model as long as we get like enough clients, essentially. It was like totally volume based. And that's fine. But from a studio perspective, that didn't really make a whole lot of sense, because with the amount of work that could potentially happen, I know the hope for a lot of people is that, like, well, they'll only need to use it sometimes. They won't need it all the time.
Right.
But think about, if people are using that, like, what are you going to do if you're a team of eight and you've got like 10 clients that all need 60 seconds worth of stuff 1 month, and all of that only ends up being like,
yeah,
70 grand a month or something like that? Like, that doesn't work out.
Your host, mathematically. Yeah, your host.
You know, you're screwed. So I think if I were to do something like that, one, I would get a team and just build a whole arm of the company that is just for that. You know, like, I wouldn't want it to intertwine with any of the normal project-based stuff, because maybe that means it's for like specific types of projects or something that fall in that bucket. But I think for freelancers, it could work pretty well, because as a freelancer, as long as you don't take on too many clients, essentially what you could do is get a very similar like salary position that you could get by going to work in-house, but you'd still have all of the freedom of being a freelancer and still being able to get that salary. And they won't need to use it all the time. So as long as you understand what your, like, if you can understand what salary you'd want from that company, I think you could pretty easily just build out your salary as a personal business just by having like two or three clients or something like that as an individual. You just really got to be careful about like how specific you are with the restrictions on what that money gets people. And I think that's especially hard to do with animation compared to some of these other things. So,
yeah. Okay. So let's dig into this a little bit. So, you know, for anyone listening that isn't familiar with the way like gym memberships work. Okay. So to me, that was my instinct was, okay, this could work if it's the same as a gym membership. And the way those work, from my understanding, is, you know, so I've got LA Fitness down the road from me, and they charge you, you know, 40, 50 bucks a month or something. You can go to Planet Fitness for 10 bucks a month. And the problem is, you cannot make a profit when someone's paying you 10 bucks a month to come to your gym that costs millions of dollars to build. So what you're going to need, you know, 1,000 people or more paying that every single month. But your gym can't hold that many people. So, you know, and this has been borne out, and there's like Harvard Business, you know, case studies on this, of like 90% of the people never go to the gym and they don't cancel their membership. And that's literally the business model. You're counting on that. It's the same thing. I have a buddy, one of my neighbors, he used to own a car wash. Same kind of deal. They would always try to sell these memberships. So you get like, look, you can get unlimited car washes with this membership. If everyone did that and used it, they'd go out of business.
Yeah.
But they know that like, it's literally going to be 1 in 10 people are ever going to use it. Mm-hmm. You know, so was that the hope? You know, when you were kind of doing the numbers that like, okay, well, if we get 10 clients, but only one at a time is asking for stuff, then it works.
Yeah. It was trying to think through how we could cascade that schedule. So like people would have a period to request a project, and then we would tell them when the delivery date could be on that. And that would let us set the schedule on the back end so that we could still keep it profitable. But the issue is that when you're dealing with, I mean, even though $8,000 for 60 seconds is much lower than what we would charge, it's still a lot more than $10 for a gym membership, you know? And so it's going to be hard for any business to justify something. Like, they're going to be way more careful about putting something like that on their finances. Like, it's just so much more money.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so, but even as if a freelancer was trying to do this, so so I'm being skeptical right now, but in a minute, I want to try to figure out with you maybe how could this work? Is there a world where this actually does work? But if you're a freelancer and you do this with one or two clients, your best clients, and they put you on retainer, and it's maybe sort of a cost plus thing where if you go over the amount of hours that you're guaranteeing them, they pay you extra, but they're getting a discount because the retainer. Okay, maybe that works. But even then, I mean, a good freelancer, you know, during the boom years, the COVID years, I knew freelancers making $300K and $400K. I don't know how many clients on retainer you'd need to be able to do that, you know? And Yeah, it seems tricky. So so I mean, you've gone over kind of the most, I think, obvious things that were kind of challenges. Was there anything surprising about it? Like, you know, you mentioned you try to sell this through to clients and that the low price was actually a downside in a weird way.
Yeah, it was scaring people off because they, like, anybody that we were reaching out to, especially if it was somebody who didn't know who we were, if it was just cold outreach, if there's someone like working at Apple or something like that, okay, and they see a budget like that, they're like, there's no way I can trust what's going to come out of this if it only costs this much. Yeah. You know, that was definitely surprising. And I think also, I don't know, just everything about it was just strange. It's like a boat that, like, you plug one of the holes that's leaking and then a million other ones pop up. You just, like, uncover more stuff under rocks that you just don't expect with this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think overall it really was just like, we cannot even project numbers on this stuff, because even if, and I mean, we had annual, quarterly, and monthly plans, and then you decrease the cost based on if they go longer. What if somebody does monthly? Like, sure, you're getting the most money that way, but they could just leave the next month. There's still no real way to guarantee. Oh, and you got to be real careful with how short these periods can be of payment, because someone could have totally just used us and taken advantage of that system and been like, oh, these guys are so silly. Because imagine you're somebody who's been scoping out, taking a project from us, let's say like 60 seconds for 40K or something like that. And you're like, oh, they want to try this thing. I can get this for $8,000? Okay. And then they could have just canceled the next month.
Absolutely.
Like, what is stopping them from doing that? And then they still got what they wanted, but like, sure, we got our subscription working or whatever.
So when, I know there's a guy on Twitter, is it Design Joy?
Yep. That was the primary inspiration for us on that.
Yeah. So I don't know his business model, but I actually know other people who have run businesses like this.
Yep.
And the, you know, some of them are upfront about this, most are not. The secret is they're hiring designers offshore. Mm-hmm. They're hiring designers who, you know, and sometimes they're getting really talented people, but they live in the Philippines or, you know, somewhere like that where, like, the cost of living is way lower and they can pay them $500 a month.
Yeah.
And it becomes a currency arbitrage thing. You know, do you think that this could work if someone was ethically okay with that? I mean, is that maybe how you can actually make the numbers work?
Well, yeah, because at that point, you effectively are just building a studio with ridiculously low overhead, you know? And you can just get as many people as you need as long as you keep your subscription price high enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So School of Motion, for a little while, we were testing out the design version of this. There was a company called Design Pickle we tried. There was another one, I can't remember, it was Super something, but we tried them both. And, you know, like, for what we were paying, like, we were getting okay stuff. It's just the quality is so bad, you know?
I know.
And you have to beat the designer up to get what you want. I mean, maybe if we were a business that didn't care about design or didn't have the sophistication to know good from bad, maybe that'd be okay. But I think for any brand that has real budgets, they're going to have taste and they're not going to want, you know, so, like, you get what you pay for, right?
Yeah.
So,
At that point, if it is a company that doesn't have those design sensibilities and doesn't really care about it that much, they just feel like it's something they should do, why wouldn't they just get somebody to do it for them and just use Canva or something like that? You know, it will be cheaper anyway than what you'd probably have to charge for a service like that, you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't want that for the design industry. However, you know, from a cost perspective, I just think that might make more sense in that situation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a realist, so, you know, I don't want to be an ostrich, put my head in the sand and pretend that these things don't exist. And,
right.
You know, that I think that kind of leads nicely into the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is sort of the future of all of this. So, you know, like, it's really interesting talking to younger artists like you, where you came up in this industry when it was already, like, getting mature. It wasn't quite mature yet, but it's fairly mature now. I feel like there's a lot of players in it. And, you know, motion design used to mean a pretty specific thing. For a while, it literally meant explainer videos. Like, that's, I think, what was in most people's minds. And now it's expanded quite a bit, and you've got, you know, a lot of UI and UX animation. You've got Rive, the new app that's, like, making a lot of noise.
Yep.
You've got, you know, multiple 3D apps, and now you've got, like, the Sphere in Las Vegas, so everyone's aware that you can do these amazing, like, motion design things on surfaces. And so I'm curious, like, from your perspective, when I say motion design, what pops into your head?
Oh, boy. Two tracks for me with this.
Minecraft, obviously.
Well, yeah, of course, Minecraft. Yeah. But that is part of it, kind of, like, it's foundation to me. I think motion design is a fantastic place to just become a very well-rounded creative. I think there are just things you learn by being in this industry that you could take and use for any creative field in some way. So that's part of it to me. From that, I am feeling a lot, despite being in it for such a short amount of time, it does feel just a lot more saturated than it used to be. It feels like it is becoming, for a lot of people, the next like get rich quick or like here's the next skill to learn type thing, but it's not really coming from a place of passion. And I think that's affecting our industry in a lot of ways, especially financially. You know, it feels like there is a bit more of like a race to the bottom from a pricing standpoint on some things. And it used to be, it felt like, I say used to be, even though it was only 4 years ago or whatever. Yeah. However,
back like, in my day,
back when I was a youngster, it just felt like there was such a smaller pool of freelancers, you know, especially qualified freelancers for working with some of the larger studios and things.
Yeah.
But now it really feels like the skills are just a lot more accessible and quickly. So it just feels like it's getting harder to diversify yourself. Part of what that means to me is why we do a lot of social content and why we like the personal branding so much. It's not because we want to just be an influencer or like be that annoying guy that pops up on Instagram all the time. But in a world where there are a lot of people learning the skill or just getting a lot of things from like the same points of influence in their journey, I think a lot of the ways that we can become unique is to just kind of avoid thinking about that process and like, oh, I need to make my work feel more this way or whatever. I think it's really just relying more on yourself as a person and realizing like somebody else is not going to be that person. If as long as you are following what your like passion and instinct is, if you care about this industry, you know, or the craft, like I feel like that will inherently cause some sort of rise, you know? And so I don't know if there's like a word that sums all of that up for that part of it, but it's just kind of like an uncertainty of like what that looks like and if people will rise to the occasion and sort of stop the industry from kind of just cloning a bunch of motion designers, you know?
Yeah.
I'm hoping that there's more of a resurgence of like, ooh, there's like a bunch of really exciting new people that are out there. And I can see that in some places.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I see you and your team as some of that, because it felt like for years, and to be honest, like I'm guilty of kind of perpetuating this too, I think, through School of Motion. Like there's, you know, the heroes that I came up in this industry kind of worshiping, you know, Buck and PSYOP and studios like that, and Jorge, right? You know, Not Ordinary Folk. You know, like every time they do something, it's amazing. And so we talk about it. And it's funny, it's like very easy to miss all of the young artists that are coming up that are doing really cool, amazing stuff. And that's, you know, earlier in the interview, I mentioned like seeing these Minecraft music videos people are making, and they're really like innovating. I mean, you know, I'm sure they're using Blender and they're teaching themselves how to do this, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I think motion design needs a little bit more of that. So I wrote this article for Motionographer years ago. It was actually probably before you were doing this at all, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago. But in it, I tried to like define motion design, and I asked a bunch of people in the industry what they thought. And one of the guys I asked was Adam Plouffe, who runs Battle Axe. So they make Overlord. And yeah, I mean, like, let's absolutely, let's toast to Mr. Plouffe. But he had this great answer. He said, I don't see motion design as a skill or as an industry. It's more of like this collection of skills that then you can apply to whatever, right? So, you know, he applied it to building a software business, essentially, you know, and I look at like Rive. I don't know if you've, dove into that app yet, but it's amazing. I'm actually having the CEO on the podcast pretty soon.
Ooh, sweet.
And there, you know, the way that that's being used, you know, Duolingo, like they're this giant app, like almost all their animation is being done in Rive now. And all of that's motion design. And you've got the Sphere in Las Vegas, and you've got the Meta Quest 3 coming out, and it's going to make AR so much more accessible. All of that, right? Even, you know, all these new things, Gaussian splatting. How are motion designers going to be using that? And so I, you know, to me, it's like, it's hard to say what motion design is. I'm not even sure it's possible. So what are you looking at as far as like the future of where Ruvy goes, right? So, I mean, you know, on your portfolio, you can go look right now. Everyone will link to it in the show notes. It's awesome stuff. And a lot of it, you know, like you just did a big project for Chick-fil-A, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. So you're doing advertising, you're doing explainer stuff. You showed me something that you did for like a conference, right?
Yeah.
So you're doing live event stuff. And that all is still fairly traditional motion design sort of applications. But what are the other things that you're looking at? I mean, obviously you want to do something for the Sphere in Vegas.
Of course. It's going to be the new thing. I want it so bad.
Yeah. By the way, just randomly, I talked to the owner of a studio who did a lot of work when they opened that thing up. But I asked him if he'd come on and talk about it. And he's like, We can't talk about it. We signed.
Dude.
Yeah, it's like NDA. Everything's NDA now. You know, it's the same
thing,
dude. If you do anything for Apple, you can't tell anybody. So.
That's always how it goes, man.
It sucks. Right? Chick-fil-A doesn't care; they'll let you, but not the Sphere.
No.
But anyway, so I'll let you answer. What kind of stuff are you interested in working on, and what do you think is going to be big in the next 10 years?
So, I mean, COVID naturally created a huge void for people wanting experiences, whether that means AR or VR, like digital experiences, which is crazy to me that like the Sphere is basically just the most insane version of VR you can get. They just built the thing for it.
Yeah.
It's going to be experiential in some way. I think events, as much as they already have been big things in the past, I think that will be the new explainer video. If the past 10 years has been the decade of the explainer, I think now it's going to be the decade of the conferences and the events, whether it's for corporations or charities or whatever it is. That seems to be the next logical step to me. And aside from that, I think it's going to be a lot more interactive. Obviously, Rive is pushing that forward a lot. But there's also, I think, going to be a lot of opportunity where, hopefully, anyway, studios especially, like I said earlier, take that creativity back into themselves in the same way that they've been offering it to all these businesses for so long. I want to see more moments where studios are making games and other fun interactive things like that. You've got Hobbs making cool tools and stuff all the time.
Ivy Studio does a lot of that.
Yeah. Like, I want to see that. I want to see studios, like, rather than only being able to show the stuff that they make for clients and those sorts of things, I want to see that creative endeavor from people in our industry that's just because it's something they want to make. Not necessarily from an art perspective. It could be a game that they want to go and sell, like Buck's been doing, or those sorts of things. But that, I think, is what's most interesting to me. I hope that people are able to get a good bounty of revenue from the traditional ways that we have in the past with just client related projects and those sorts of things. But I really hope that people start to realize just how, like you said, that umbrella of our skill set can enable them to create anything that anybody could want to use or play or buy or whatever. And I would just like to see us as creatives embrace that a little bit more.
I love that. So you're using the toolbox, like, you know, Adam Plouffe talked about using that in these sort of entrepreneurial ways, which, dude, I'm all for. So the last question I have for you, Austin, is, you know, like, I've got my list of influences and my favorite animators and studios and all of that. And, you know, I talk about this with my contemporaries in the industry, that it always feels like we mention the same 5 or 10, you know, people in studios. It's kind of, and some of it's just laziness, right? Just to be honest, you know, but some of it is also, it's like, it's kind of hard. Like, you kind of, especially online, you end up in these bubbles where, okay, everyone in my bubble is the people that have, you know, are in their like 30s and 40s. And I'm not seeing like all the amazing artists that are in their 20s. And by following you and following Ravi, now I'm starting to see some of that, and it's amazing. So I'm curious, like, you know, who are you looking at? Who do you think's doing awesome work? It could be a person, it could be a studio.
So there's two people that come to mind. One, he goes by Seven, but his name is Wanil So. And it's great. Like, he has a good amount of followers on Instagram, but he is so insanely underrated. He just turned 18, like a couple months ago. And every video that he puts out that he makes personally looks like it could have been done entirely by ordinary folk for a client project. It is nuts. This dude goes, sure to get you his handle and all that sort of stuff. But I love what he's doing, not only because the work is great, but also he's been in our community for a little while. And he lives in South Korea. He's got a bunch of his friends, just like this group of like 7, 18-year-old South Korean just teens just making a ton of awesome motion work together. They just did a project for Samsung a couple months ago as well, which it's just wild. They are absolutely going to make a studio at some point. Right now, it's kind of just like a loose collective thing, but 100% they will be huge.
Love it.
Another person who's very prominent in our community as well, Gordon Howie. He is I believe he's Scottish. I really hope that's right. Scottish. He's a Scottish motion designer, and he just makes such awesome character work. Even if it's not like a traditional looking character, he just manages to put eyes and faces on stuff and just make it so engaging. He's been in a lot of our challenges and things, and the work he makes is just so fun. And he has had one of the more viral posts that I've ever seen. He just made a submission for one of our challenges. He only had like a week to do it or something. And he got like almost 1 million views on Instagram just in a couple days. Dude shot from like 1,000 followers to like 15,000 or something like that. It was crazy. But he also is really involved in his own community. Like he started this event that he runs around the UK with a couple other people just as like a local motion design get together and hang out for animation. So I think those are two super valuable people in the community.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, cool. Well, thank you. I'm going to have to follow them and, and maybe we'll get them on the pod one day, you know?
Got
to
do it.
Love it. I mean, I think I'm trying to think. You might be the youngest person who's ever been on the podcast. I'd have to go back and look. But
I'm
if
honored.
We had an 18-year-old, that would definitely
then I'll lose the title real fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's
You'd be
okay.
second place. That's okay. Listen, yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much for doing this. It was awesome chatting with you.
Of course, man. Glad to be here. Loved it.
Head to ruvy.co to see the amazing work coming out of the studio. You know, there's something in the water in North Carolina right now. It's becoming a little bit of a hub for design and animation. Austin, thank you so much for the transparency about your business, about what's worked and what hasn't, and for carrying the torch of motion design well into the future. I really can't wait to see what Austin and the Ruvy crew get up to next, and I cannot wait to see you on the next episode. So make sure you are subscribed so you don't miss any of the interviews we're doing. We have some ballers coming up shortly, and that's it for this one. Bye.